I am Plata of the Line in Vancouver, British Columbia at thecommentary.ca. A new book that is a combination of memoir, feminist theory, as well as an engaging look at geography and popular culture is Feminist City, a Field Guide by Leslie Kern, who joins me now. The book tackles the challenge of claiming urban space from barriers designed to keep women in their place. Professor Kern also looks at friendship and its place in urban centers and how it might be different than, say, in suburbs. We'll also discuss accessibility, not just for women, but all minorities. Leslie Kern is the author of Sex in the Revitalized City, Gender, Condominium Development, and Urban Citizenship. She is Associate Professor of Geography and Environment and Director of Women's and Gender Studies at Mount Allison University in Sackville, New Brunswick, where I reached her last week. She will be in Vancouver this Wednesday, the 27th of November, at the Morris J. Wask Center for Dialogue, 580 West Hastings, as part of a panel on how to build a more just, sustainable Vancouver, moderated by Ellen Woodsworth. That's at 7 p.m. Visit the SFU Institute of the Humanities for more, as they are co-hosting the event. This new book is published by Between the Lines. Please welcome to the Plante Online program, Leslie Kern. Professor Kern, good morning.
Good morning. Great to talk to you, Joe.
Good to talk to you. How often do you get people coming up to you, men especially, saying, hey, I didn't think of that, or I never looked at it that way?
Great question. Maybe not as often as I should. Hopefully after the book has been out there, we'll get a little bit more of that.
Yeah.
But I think your question points to one of the things that the book is trying to do, which is just to make visible a set of experiences that if you, you know, haven't been through them yourself, like pushing a stroller through a revolving door to get to the subway station, you just might not have thought of it before.
Yeah, there's a lot of things in the book, and I'm disappointed, I should say, that I hadn't noticed a lot of these things. I say that as a guy, right? You know, I get around the city using public transit and the sort, and there are a lot of things that I just never thought of.
Exactly. You know, and for myself as well, you know, as an able-bodied person, it really wasn't until I had my daughter and I was living in London, England at the time, that some of those both physical and social barriers started to become really apparent to me. And like you, I sort of had a moment where I thought, yeah, I've never thought of this before and never had thought about how this affected disabled people, elderly people, people with other kinds of mobility issues and other mothers like myself until I was literally, you know, in wearing those shoes.
So you mentioned this time that you spent in England, in London especially. Reading your book, I found it fascinating when you talk about, you know, just how the Victorians, I guess, screwed it up for everyone and their view on women and their place in society. I mean, it really shows in how that city itself was designed. It was designed for men, wasn't it?
Absolutely. It was designed around a very strict sort of social ordering that was not just gendered, but was also classed and racialized. Mm. So your status in that society, it was very important not just to have that status, but for that status to be well-marked and visible to everybody else in order to maintain that order. But I guess one of the things that's interesting about that period is you know, that following the Industrial Revolution, things start to get shaken up in that social order, and that's when you really see, you know, kind of a moral panic over the place of women in the city. You know, are they allowed out in public on their own, and what kinds of urban spaces can be created for them that both protect their status and will not have them, God forbid, mistaken for a sex worker on the street.
Right. Now, did you grow up in Toronto?
Yeah, I was born in Toronto, grew up in Mississauga, and then back to Toronto for university.
So what's fascinating, because the way that the book's written, it's not. I mean, you are an academic, but it's not. It has that stuff, if you will, but it's also rather engaging when you talk about yourself or you talk about your experiences with various cities that you lived in. looking at, say, the way Toronto has evolved over the years, I mean, cities like London, England, Toronto, I mean, the way that they're, I guess, mapped out, the way that they're shaped, has largely excluded the experience of women. I was going to ask you why that is, but I think that's probably evident why, because those are the sorts of people that have had, you know, the levers of power over the years. How does this change, and what does a feminist city look like?
Yeah, so that is the ultimate question, isn't it? I mean, as you said, it's clear that the people who have been designing, planning cities, architects, policymakers, politicians have largely been men, and they've been men of a particular class group, with all sorts of other privileges that has not always taken the time to look at what the multiplicity of urban experiences really is, including those around gender. So a feminist city, I mean, one starting point really is to start to apply a gender lens to all sorts of decisions that can be made in cities. So one of the examples that I think got some, you know, airplay here in Canada a couple of years ago was about whether things like snowplow budgets and timelines should have a gender analysis built into them. And people are like, what? Snowplows?
Yeah.
Snow is snow. Like, what does snow have to do with gender? But in fact, when you look at the patterns of how women versus men commute, the geographies of their commute patterns, the kinds of places that they need to get to, we see that what has been prioritized is the sort of typical male commuter freeway driving pattern in terms of snow removal, and places like the side streets, residential streets, school zones, and so on have been bike lanes, much more secondary. Mm. And those, you know, pedestrian, bike, school, residential zones are where women need to get to even on a snow day.
Yeah, and again, this is stuff that one never thinks of, but it becomes something that people think of, I guess, if they have the experience of taking their children to school or taking them along as they complete the tasks of the day. Was it for you? I mean, you mentioned the experience of becoming a mom and living in London at the time. I guess these things, I don't know, but I'm assuming that's the first time you thought of these things, but you probably thought about them before, right?
Well, I was certainly a feminist before. I had a women's and gender studies degree from my undergrad, so I was certainly aware of sexism in general. But what I hadn't noticed so much was how the physical environment and the way the social environment is built into the physical environment, I hadn't really noticed how that also plays a role in, you know, gender divisions and sexism in society until some of those physical barriers became very apparent to me. So it was kind of a bringing together of, like, my women's studies education with this new kind of geographical sense of power and how it was playing out in my life.
You know, I was thinking a moment ago, Leslie, that if men, a greater number of men had the responsibility of, say, rearing children, taking them around on public transportation and sort of living in the city with children as women do, probably things would improve. But at the same time, do you think the system itself discourages that in a way?
Yeah, I think you've hit on a really important point here, which is that the way that we've set up so much of our physical environment, whether it's through the arrangement of the kind of suburban home and commuters, public transit, it does actually kind of work in this sort of feedback loop. So not only have traditionally women been more responsible for childcare and domestic work and so on, but the very physical arrangement of our cities and their suburbs and our homes has worked to kind of perpetuate that, because it's the built environment around us is very durable. And sometimes, even though our social norms change, like many of us would agree, yes, men should do more housework, women are free to pursue careers outside of the home and their own interests, and yet the environment around us keeps kind of molding us, pushing us back into these roles that we think are outdated.
Yeah. I also found fascinating that the chapter on socializing and what that means in a city as opposed to elsewhere. The idea that, say, living in an urban setting forces us to interact with one another. I mean, I guess that's what Jacob said made a good city. But at the same time, the idea that we can live wherever we want and be free to spend the time alone, that's something that you talk about in the book, right?
Yes, because I think many women would be able to share an experience of just kind of going about their day, minding their own business, and feeling a range of intrusions. And I'll be honest, it's usually from men, whether it's of the more offensive kind, like catcalling harassment, or just this kind of, you know, hey, what are you reading? Where are you going? Why don't you smile? Nice sunglasses. These things just kind of like they add up over time. They might seem innocuous, like, oh, who cares? That's not a big deal. But over time, it's, you know, the constancy of it and the fact that for women, because there is so much violence and harassment, we're never sure when that innocent interaction could turn into something more dangerous.
Right.
So we have this kind of constant state of vigilance that we're in, and, you know, in the book I talk a little bit about how, you know, wearing headphones for women is like one little way of trying to signal, like, hey, please don't talk to me right now. Give me that privacy that everybody else seems entitled to here.
Yeah, and again, as a guy, I've never thought of it that way. I mean, a guy doesn't get that sort of interaction with people in public that women do, and a marvelous way that you've pointed that out is how the book's designed, with the French flaps. And for people listening to us, can you describe what the back flap, I mean, how that could be used, say?
Sure. So the book designer wanted to think about the book as a little bit of a feminist object and perhaps even a feminist urban defense object. So if you open the book to the back flap, it says, in case of harassment, open flap, and the flap says, fuck off, I'm reading. So the idea being that, you know, in case of emergency, one could flash that to your fellow commuters who are trying to chat you up or irritate you on the subway.
Exactly. The idea of female friendship, because you write about that in the book, I guess that's different in the city versus living elsewhere, isn't it?
Well, I think the city offers a lot of ways of facilitating ongoing friendships for women in ways that suburban environments might not, in that there's at least a little bit more sense of kind of collective space in cities and ease of transportation, more spaces that are amenable to that kind of regular social contact than you might find in other sorts of environments.
Yeah, well, you write about Sex and the City, and you mentioned the Golden Girls. You mentioned how people nowadays look at both programs and, you know, look at them as goals, say, in terms of something they'd like to pursue. What do you make of that idea that the Golden Girls, for example, of four women living together, that's something that people want to do, say, now or in the future. It makes that show awfully nostalgic, doesn't it?
Absolutely. Yeah, I think what I'm getting at there is that people are becoming a lot more open to imagining other kind of household and kinship relationships that are outside the kind of either heterosexual or heteronormative nuclear family form. And so one of the points that I'm trying to make in thinking about friendship is that if we could value friendship in the ways that we tend to value and legitimize and legalize other forms of relationships, in particular intimate romantic relationships, then that opens up a lot of interesting things in cities, for example, in terms of what kinds of household arrangements might we imagine? What would it look like for, especially with an aging population? You know, it's not great for people to be kind of isolated in their homes, either as a pair or an individual. And so can we broaden our thinking, use our imaginations for thinking about other forms of households and relationships?
I'm jumping all over the place because there's just so much in the book that I want to talk about. But the idea of public space also interested me because how they're used and how we view them, I think, is an important thing to consider. About a block and a half, 2 blocks from where I live, is this huge green space that's used for sport and the sort. Beer league is right, but you know, beer league soccer or it's one of those things where it's got, you know, baseball diamonds in each corner, so it could be used for that. It's a lovely thing to have in the middle of a neighborhood, but it's not as inviting as I suppose a park would be, or any other sort of public space, even if it's just concrete. Even though it's so close to where I live, it's something that I've never been to. That's something that you talk about in terms of access, that's important in terms of how we cultivate these spaces, how we maintain them. We need to think about that, don't we?
We certainly do, because it's really, unfortunately, it's not good enough to just sort of create a space and designate it as a public space. A lot of thought needs to go into, okay, what kinds of activities are going to be done in this space? And as you mentioned, with the kind of like, you know, beer league, softball league, sometimes these spaces get kind of implicitly gendered in the ways that they get used, even though there's not, certainly I'm sure there's not a rule that says only men's sports.
Exactly.
But over time, you know, you kind of that kind of use takes over, and other people might feel implicitly excluded from the space. Certainly wide open spaces, we might think, okay, you know, this seems like a safe space, but sometimes people can feel very kind of isolated and targeted in wide open spaces, especially at night. We also have to think about, you know, how is a space used over time? A space that might feel really safe and fun during the day could be extremely daunting at night. Or if a space just doesn't get used very often, then it becomes less of an amenity and more of a problem to be solved.
Yeah. And I mean, there's all kinds of things, not just looking at it from gender or race, but class as well. I guess the key in terms of your book is that if the maximum number of people can find value or use of the city, I guess that's the better it is, isn't it? And throughout your travels, I mean, you'll be in Vancouver shortly, there are still a lot of barriers for a lot of people in terms of the city, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. And one of the things that I hope people who maybe have some decision-making power in cities might take away is that a plea for a feminist city is not just, oh, make the city better, easier, safer for women, but that many of the things that are described, as you say, are actually things that are really beneficial to lots of people, right? So accessibility, for example, very beneficial if you're pushing a stroller, but more important for disabled people, elderly people, and so on. Issues around safety, we have to be really careful there that we don't equate safety with like more police, because that is not necessarily making everybody safe. So we have to think not just in terms of the traditional ways that cities have gone about creating an appearance of safety, but how could we actually structure our spaces and our social relations such that people do feel good about being in the public realm and not threatened either by one another or by forces like security or the police. So, yeah, the conversation that I'm trying to open up here is one about a wider vision for a kind of just and sustainable city.
Now, motivating policymakers, politicians especially, for a lot of activists, is an awfully difficult task. So what do you think is the benefit, I guess? I mean, if you had to sell this to someone in a decision-making capacity to make a better city, to make a feminist city, what would you tell them?
really good question. So maybe I would think about three basic things. One, an economic argument, which is that if you reduce barriers to access and movement across the city, then you're going to be opening up the opportunity for people to make a better economic contribution, whether that's in terms of their employment, entrepreneurship, going back to school, just participating in public life in ways that are economically beneficial rather than relying on some other source of support. Mm-hmm. I think there's also an environmental argument to be made. Obviously, we are in a climate change area. Cities, especially cities on the sea like Vancouver, are got to be really thinking really hard about what kinds of changes they need to make in terms of sustainability. And certainly some of the things that I think go along with a feminist city in terms of accessible transportation, walkability, interconnected access of services and work also have a component of an environmental sustainability to them.
Yeah, the climate crisis, I mean, a feminist city will certainly alleviate that, won't it?
Well, I think it's part of the puzzle. Yeah. And partly what I want people to think about as well is, like, yes, climate change is a crisis. We've got to be doing everything we can, but we also can't, in the meantime, ignore social relations.
Right.
So I don't think that we can, like, solve, you know, climate crisis or engage in some kind of urban climate mitigation without thinking about gender, race, and class, in particular as issues that are also connected into things like climate justice. So they're all part of the puzzle.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, you can think of it from the view that say, certain classes don't think about it as a crisis. And so if you make a city more inclusive, say, or include a lot more people in the debate, it'll get people hip to the idea that it is a crisis, I suppose.
Absolutely, and making sure that the kinds of solutions that we come up with don't even unintentionally exacerbate already existing, class, racial, and gender divides in society.
Yeah. The other thing I was thinking about is the levels of participation in politics. I guess those can be improved, and if those are improved, I guess a better city, a better representation obviously comes about, and so so you have a better city, you have a better country, don't you?
I think so. I think the international data shows that when women are elected in greater numbers to, you know, whatever levels of government, then greater attention does start to be paid to what have, you know, been considered women's issues, whether that's care, housing, education, those sorts of things. So it's you know, not a total magic bullet. Not every woman who comes into office has those things as a priority, but over time, it does start to shift the conversation.
You'll be in Vancouver shortly, I guess as someone who lives here, and most of the people listening will be from this part of the world, what works here and what doesn't work? I mean, is that something that you've thought about, say, not just in the course of writing this book, but in the course of your work as an urban geographer?
Well, one of the things that I know is a particular issue in Vancouver is the question of gentrification.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that's something that will probably come up at the event next week. People might want to know what are some of the connections between thinking about a feminist vision of the city and gentrification. And certainly, you know, I'll be interested to talk about how, you know, a feminist city would embrace kind of an anti-gentrification ethos, both in terms of issues of affordability and the fact that women are typically much more vulnerable in the housing market and are deeply affected by issues of displacement when they're already juggling multiple roles in their lives, being displaced from the areas of the city that might facilitate them juggling those roles tends to have an even more detrimental effect on that. As for what Vancouver does well, I mean, I think Vancouver has a vibrant social movement in it that are addressing things like the climate crisis. They're addressing Indigenous rights and decolonization. They're addressing issues of poverty and substance abuse in the downtown East Side and other areas of the city. And so I think that kind of vibrant political engagement is something really exciting about Vancouver.
Now, you live in Sackville. You live and work in Sackville. It's I guess, a lot less urban than, say, London, England or Toronto. Some people might wonder what it's like to talk about this stuff in the setting that you live and work in. There's a bit of irony there, isn't there?
Absolutely. You know, for about 10 years, I've lived in this small town. It's about 5,000 people. One of the things that it's really showed me, though, you know, when I do travel fairly often to cities like Toronto, Montreal, Vancouver, is the ways in which urban life really, like, settles into your body in a certain way. Uh-huh. So, and particularly as a woman, you know, when you walk around the city and somebody honks their horn, your reaction is likely to be one of defensiveness or fear, or maybe you're going to give them the finger, because you assume that it's, you know, hostile or sexualized in some way. Whereas when I walk around a small town in Saskatchewan, somebody honks, it's my neighbor or my colleague from my department. So I have to kind of let my guard down a little bit here. There's lessons to be learned in small towns, too, about the values of slowing down, right? The values of taking a moment for those social interactions with the people that you encounter in the local shop and so on. And I think some of those things can and are recreated in cities, particularly in neighborhoods, and I certainly value them a lot now when I travel back.
Yeah. Now, I understand you wrote this book as the Me Too movement was exploding. What was it like writing about what you write about in the book and seeing what was going on around you? I mean, did you sense sort of a change? And I don't know if optimism might be too strong a word. I mean, was there any of that at all as you were writing this book?
Well, I think there's really a strong appetite for a deeper analysis of the ways in which things like harassment affect women in such a deep and profound way. And certainly those discussions of things like workplace harassment and harassment at school and in a wide variety of industries connects really well to the experiences that women talk about when they detail what street harassment is like. So even though this may be a difference in terms of being harassed by strangers versus people that you know, there's similarities in terms of the ways in which it's a constant reminder, like, you don't belong here. You have something to fear here. You owe somebody else something. And all of this kind of feeds into those, like, rape culture myths about, you know, women's responsibility for their own victimization and so on. So I think that at this moment, the optimistic thing is that people are talking about it in a deeper way, right? Harassment not as something that you can just brush off, but as something that has deep and long-lasting effects.
Yeah. I could talk all day with you because there's just so much in this book that I enjoyed and that you gave me lots to think about. I urge people to pick this up. It's such a great book. Continued good luck with it. I so appreciate your time today.
Thank you. It's been great to talk to you, Joe.
The book is called Feminist City, A Field Guide. Leslie Kern is its author. She joined me on the line from Sackville, New Brunswick. In Vancouver, I'm Joseph Plato.